Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times and Managing Editor of First Draft, the great Carl Hulse. And remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. And we're going to get to as many as we can, and don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the link to our sponsors, Real Paper, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. James, this has been an extraordinary week in sports, particularly professional and college football in the last five or six days, some unbelievable games, including one from a place you used to teach, Tulane. Great playoff games, getting ready for the TCU-Georgia championship game. But probably one of the most tragic stories in the history of the game was the Buffalo Bills-Cincinnati game the other day when the Buffalo safety, I think his name is Damar Hamlin, suffered a serious coronary attack after a blow, and was taken to the hospital in critical condition. I guess he's fighting for his life. And they stopped the game. They suspended the game, as I think they ought to have. I think it's the human story is clearly, paramount here. But the NFL is in a bit of a dilemma, too. What do they do about that game? I don't see any time they can play it.
Okay, so first of all, the coaches decided right away they weren't going to play the game.
Right.
That was pretty evident. And there was no, the game must go on. That's just not the modern world we live in. Now, this is the problem, Al. They can declare it no contest, or they could declare it a tie. They're probably not going to say, because Cincinnati was ahead, Cincinnati wins, but I don't know if that's an option. The problem is this. If they declare it no contest, Kansas City will be 14-3, and Buffalo will be 13-3. Now, the bye is really critical in the NFL. I mean, it's not a BS thing because you don't have to play the first week of the playoffs. All right, who gets the bye? Kansas City has the better winning percentage because they played one more game. Buffalo beat Kansas City in Kansas City.
Back in October, yeah.
So this is something that's under discussion. There's a two-week lag between the championship games and the Super Bowl. All right, push everything back a week. And next Sunday, a week from Sunday, Cincinnati and Buffalo play. That game would get an audience like you wouldn't freaking believe. All right, because this has real, and sports leagues are very cognizant of the integrity of the playoffs. And that's a possibility that's being floated. Now, they like having it 2 weeks before the Super Bowl, but you want competition to decide it. This may be an option. I have no idea.
Well, you're absolutely right. Let me just explain this. Right now, each conference has seven teams make the playoff. six teams, three play in the first round, and one team, the best team with the team with the best record, gets a bye. So that's the stakes James was talking about. Who gets that bye? That's a week off. That's an incredibly valuable.
Right. The difference between being the four seed and the five seed, you could say, well, okay, shit. Yeah.
Right.
But this is a distinction with a huge difference. And my experience with the NFL, and this is true of all sports leagues, they will take the path that has the most money. And the most money is to play the Bengals-Bills game, you know, a week after the season ends, and then push everything back a week. That thing would get a freaking rating like you wouldn't believe.
I agree with you, but they will lose a little bit of money by not having that extra week between the Super Bowl. They do an awful lot of stuff in that week. But
I like it. It just, you know, builds up suspense and everything else. I don't know, but they don't have – did it declare a game of tie?
Yeah.
All right, they declared no contest. I mean,
well, if they declared a tie, it doesn't resolve the Buffalo-Kansas City bye.
Right, it doesn't resolve that.
Right.
And then can the commissioner by edict say, well, Buffalo gets the bye because they beat Kansas City in Kansas City?
And then the Chiefs fans say, wait a minute, they were losing that game. They lost that game, you know, we had a bad record.
Everybody's going to say, you know, the one thing we know, you ain't going to satisfy everybody, whatever you do.
Yeah. James, one thing I say is I did not see the replay of that. I don't want to see the replay of that awful scene on the field. From what I read, it wasn't like it was a vicious hit or anything. He was the defensive player. It just was one of those absolute flukes where he hit a certain part of the heart, I guess, or the bottom of the heart, and that caused an arrest. So I don't think this was. I don't think those who say the game is too violent that this is proof of that or has anything to do with it. I am more worried, however, about the Miami Dolphins quarterback Tua, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name because I always screw it up. Had a terrible concussion 2 months ago. I think it was John Harbaugh, the coach of the Ravens, said he'd never seen anything like that in football. Many people said he just shouldn't play again, came back to play, and then he had another concussion last week. This kid is a really good quarterback. You know, he ought to stop. He ought to stop. He's just going to shorten his life.
Yeah, you know, I think he'd say he'd have a short life. I don't know, but, you know, I've listened to, obviously, a lot of cardiologists home. And this kind of thing typically does not, to the extent it happens, and it's very rare, it's more in baseball and soccer, where
your
ball hits you at a certain part of your chest and a soccer ball hits you. I don't think this, look, people have a, whether or not you want your grandson to play football is quite another question. I mean, I think people have legitimate questions about how violent the sport is, but I this is one instance where I just don't think it fits.
I totally agree. Look, on a much more upbeat note, I don't know that there has ever been a better football story, a narrative over the course of two seasons, actually, than Tulane. Your teaching alma mater, it's right down the street from where you live. Last year they were a crummy team. I think 2-10 this year they had a good record, but they went to the Cotton Bowl to play Southern Cal. Does Tulane really even belong in the same field with the powerful Trojans? Tell us about how it ended.
I'm going to tell you about this is a text I got from Daryl Berger, who was, I think he's been the chairman of Tulane board and the Vanderbilt board, but he's a dear friend of mine, from a very civic minded guy. Over the last five seasons, FBS teams were 1,692 when trailing by 15-plus points in the final 5 minutes. Tulane made it 2 out of every 1,692 today. This is an unbelievable stat. A couple other amazing features of the game. Time of possession was 2-1 USC, approximately 40 minutes to 20 minutes. USC didn't punt once. William throws for 465 yards and 5 touchdowns and was never sacked. Pratt played an incredibly gritty game and completed only 4 passes until the final drive, where he completed 4 and a touchdown. The Tulane University one-year win-loss turnaround was the greatest one-year turnaround ever in college football. The whole thing was mind-boggling, all right? That has got to be the most improbable college football game win maybe in the history of college football.
Yeah.
You look at, and I mean, Mary and I, you know, obviously we turned the LSU-Purdue game off, you know, a long time ago. And I could not believe what I was watching. I mean, it was just a stunning end. And Lincoln Riley he's beside himself. I mean, and they were trying. I mean, Southern Cal didn't mail it home. I mean, they were playing their asses off. And that he played that game another 100 times, and you know, get that result maybe one more time.
Well, it's the most improbable ending, but the whole narrative, the whole two-year narrative, is also one of the most improbable in the history of college football. So it's
right. Time of possession is everything. And how did Tulane defense, I mean, they were on the field twice as long as the Southern Cal defense. That was remarkable, you know.
Well, it was a great ending. And, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, you're going to have to make it a choice now whether you go to Tulane or LSU games, James.
Come on. One game, a lifetime. By the way, LSU's going to be top five team next year.
All right. We'll get to that next year.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
James, we have seen an historic fiasco in the House as Republicans repeatedly sought couldn't elect a speaker. There is no better person to explain all this than the New York Times chief Washington correspondent, Carl Hulse, the Michelangelo of congressional correspondence. I'll say right now, we are talking early Wednesday afternoon. The House is coming back. We don't know what the resolution might ultimately be. But as you suggested in your terrific piece today, Carl, this shows Republicans not only failed to pick a speaker, they really showed that they aren't up to governance. It really suggests they're not ready for prime time.
I mean, they're definitely going to have trouble. You know, yesterday, Al, somebody said, why do you keep doing this? You know, you've been doing it so long. I said, well, you always see something new. And I had never seen this before, contrary to reports that I was there for the 1923 multiple votes. You know, this is a group of people in the House Republican Conference, as they call themselves, as opposed to a caucus, who really don't want the government to work that well. This is their goal. They admit that. They're for limited government. They are used to voting no. I wonder how many times some of these guys have ever voted yes on a spending bill, for instance, right? So, you know, we've all been around politics a long time. Usually there's a point where you go, okay, I got what I wanted. Well, there's not exactly a want with some of these guys. And that's where I think Kevin McCarthy made his mistake. I think he thought going out there that it was going to be such a moment that a lot of these folks would cave and they just would go along with him. And as they showed, they're not going to go along with anybody. So I think it's going to be a pretty rough couple years.
He gave them, Carl, anything they wanted. They wanted a motion to vacate the chair, won 5 members, got the ethics committee, new rules for bringing committee assignments. He couldn't have given them any more.
Yeah, I think... They didn't get to the point where one member could move to vacate the chair, which actually is a demand by some of the folks.
Yeah.
But yeah, he did. And you know, he's given away the store and he still hasn't taken the keys. So they're stuck. And it's, you know, we were kind of making light of this yesterday, but it is a bit of a dangerous proposition because the House isn't organized. There is no House of Representatives right now. And I don't think that's a good thing for the country, even if you have that for a day or two.
That's right. These members haven't been sworn in. They got to elect the speaker first.
And there's no members of Congress or no members of the House right now.
To go back to all the concessions he made, even if he's not the speaker, it's going to be whoever is the speaker, whether it's him or someone else, is going to be very hard to change those, right? I mean, those are pretty locked in, I would guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to give a lot, you know, and I've been down this road before that. So both times that recently that the majorities have flipped, the Democrats, when they got back in 2006 and the Republicans in 2010 or 11, everybody promises to run a more open House. And we're going to have open amendment process and 72 hours to read the bill and all these things. And, you know, they usually last about 2 months because you just find out that you can't do things that way in the modern era. Listen, I side with a lot of the folks who say that too many deals are being cut by the leadership. You know, even senior members of the appropriations committees are cut out. You know, these things are done at the last minute. Nobody knows what's in them. But I'm not sure that the Republican push for a lot of these more open procedures are really about better governing. I think a lot of it is about less governing.
Well, you captured the, I guess I call it the crazy element in that conference.
I can't say that.
I know you can't, but I think you said they want to defund, disrupt, and dismantle. I would say destroy too. But let's talk about another group. There must be a dozen and a half Republican members who were elected in districts that Biden carried or almost carried. Five or six from New York, five from California, Tom Keene, Don Bacon out there, and Fitzpatrick in Pennsylvania. What are they doing? I mean, are they trying to organize?
Yeah, they're trying, but they're very frustrated, right? Because they don't get the same respect that the folks on the other end of the ideological spectrum do. Because people know that they'll try and do the right thing, right? They want to govern. So I mean, and they're holding out for McCarthy. You know, that's the okay only Kevin. You know, Barney Frank had a great line to me once when the Republicans had switched back and forth. And Barney said to me, he's like, asking Republicans to govern is like asking me to judge the Miss America contest. I'll do it, but I really won't enjoy it. Right. And, that stuck with me for a while. There's an element of the Republican Party that, you know, sees government as an evil. But then you have the folks you're talking about who are from districts where they want to do things, right? Here, Mitch McConnell is out in Kentucky with Joe Biden celebrating pork, right, for a big bridge project out there. I think one of the differences to me over the years that I've been here is that almost everybody used to come to Congress to get something. Right. Even if you were pretty conservative, you had a project or you had an idea or you had a policy that you wanted to get. A lot of folks in the Republican conference came here to disrupt. There's really nothing they want except to make the government go away. And you know what? The government can't go away. Americans are pretty darn dependent on it.
James.
So Carl, let's hit the rewind button here. We talk about a motion to vacate.
All right.
Honestly, 10 days ago, I didn't know what the hell that was. And I suspect that a lot of our listeners don't. So take us through what is a motion to vacate and why is it such a big deal?
Right.
How much a part of these negotiations?
Yeah. So to most people, that sounds like you're getting kicked out of your apartment, right? Right. Motion to vacate. So this was a little known provision that really came up with Boehner in 2015, that this existed, and that one member of the House could propose a motion to vacate and be what under the House is considered a privileged motion. So you would actually get a vote on it. So that's how they forced Boehner out, by threatening. And the person who was doing it, I think, was Mark Meadows, who then later aligned himself with Trump, obviously. And he was saying, you know, we're going to embarrass you, humiliate you. We're going to force you out. Motion to vacate. So that worked and got Boehner out. Of course, Kevin McCarthy then was trying to succeed Boehner, and they used it before he even got there to kind of force him aside because he didn't have the right wing lined up. And when Pelosi came back, she toughened that up. She made it so you can't really do that. And of course, the Republicans now are demanding that they have the ability anytime they want to, at the current rule, I think Al said it right, that five of them could agree, or the proposal they want. I think Kevin McCarthy wants it to be half of the Republicans would have to agree to it. The Freedom Caucus folks want five people to be able to say, okay, we're going to have a vote on the floor of the House to kick you out as Speaker. And they want the ability to do that. And that is their big sword, James, that they're going to hang over who's ever in there. And if you don't do what we say, and if you bring up a bill we don't like, or if you actually go over and visit Joe Biden at the White House, then we're going to have a motion to vacate and you're going to be in trouble. So, you know, is the job worth having if that's what you got waiting for you whenever you try and do something? And that's why I think it's going to be so hard to govern. They could move to vacate on anything.
So I'm going to make an observation, and I obviously want you to weigh in, and Al, you can weigh in too. But between the three of us, we've been around politics for a long time. And one of the things that after a particularly brutal election in Pennsylvania in 1986, the campaign managers used to have a drink after, you know, and sort of stuff. And Scranton's campaign manager, a guy named Rick Robb, who was a kind of professional Republican. I think he was like a lawyer lobbyist. He was a good guy. And I said, Rick, this has to be the most brutal campaign you've ever been in. He said, oh, no, James, nothing compares to 76 Ford and Reagan. He said, they got churches that are still split. And my observation is intra-party fights are much more intense than inter-party fights. I mean, the Democrats don't like the Republicans, okay? But I guarantee you that John Boehner hates Mark Meadows with a passion that would burn through anything more than he'll ever hate Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi, anybody else. Is that you guys, is that y'all's observation too, covering this? And going forward, this thing is kind of very difficult to repair itself.
Yeah, that's the bloodletting, right? You know, the family bloodletting is always worse than the bloodletting between people who don't know each other that well. I mean, think about the, a good comparison is the, say, senators from the same state, from the same party. They're always way more at each other's throats than senators in the same states from different parties. Some of the worst relationships in Congress are guys, Democrats or Republicans, who represent the same state. Super competitive. Yeah, I mean, how do you repair these frayed relations? Because as Al said, these moderate Republicans, you know, one, this is embarrassing for them. And two, if they end up with somebody they don't want as Speaker after, you know, holding out for McCarthy, I mean, they're going to consider them, they just got screwed by their own colleagues. So I think, you know, we all kind of expected this to happen, right? But seeing it happen is a totally different experience.
So before I turn it back to Al, it's like the Ukraine war. How does... It has to end, doesn't it?
You mean, oh, yeah. But I don't know. I don't know how. And, you know, the damage also, like the Ukraine war, the damage is really being done, right? You know, you're raising some of the buildings, some of the structures, the institution right now. I think some real damage is being done. Now, my story today, you know, I talked to Ken Buck from Colorado, conservative guy, but considered very reasonable. And he's like, well, oh, you know, the voters will forget this in a while. I don't know that that's the case. I mean, you know, the Republicans, the problem for the Republicans, as both of you guys know, is they didn't have the election that they thought they were going to have and were told they were going to have, certainly by Kevin McCarthy, right? They expected a much better outcome, which would have spared McCarthy all the trouble he's having right now. So, you know, it's there's a certain sort of reduce everything to rubble aspect among some of the Republicans. But, you know, they're going to get a Speaker. There's something will give. We're not going to go, you know, for 2 years without a House of Representatives.
Albert?
Well, you know, I thought the Ken Buck quote that you ended your piece on, the reason I feel very confident that he's wrong is because it's just not this week. It's not like we're going to have this big, you know, warfare this week and then next week all will be fine. They're going to have warfare every week or every month. I mean, it's just whether it's going to be closing the government, the debt ceiling, whatever. So I just think they're not, I just don't think, as I said, they're ready for prime time. McCarthy was, you know, had a bad hand in one way with these guys who wanted to destroy, but seems to me he made some big mistakes too. He's not a very strong guy. He was stupid to move into the speaker's office before he had the job. The optics weren't good. And I think he relied on Trump to some extent, and Trump can't deliver.
Well, now that's going to be the test, because Trump is now telling people, you know, back Kevin. But I honestly don't know exactly how much influence that's going to have. And, you know, some of these people are just not going to back him under any circumstances. I will say we were surprised, though, at the number, right? 19, 20. That's a big number. And some of those people can kind of be won back over. But, you know, I don't know how he gets there, honestly, without a wholesale change and some kind of real big moment. But the, you know, the debt limit, that's kind of terrifying, right? You know, this is a real thing. And as somebody I've covered, I've been writing, I hate to say this, guys, I've been writing debt limit stories since about 1986, but I'm sure, Al, you can probably go back farther than that.
Oh, you're just a rookie at that, Carl.
And, you know, we always knew that it was going to get resolved, right? There's going to be some pain and a bunch of back and forth, but pretty much we knew it was going to be raised and things would go on. I look at this and I'm not so sure they can do it with this crew, honest to God.
Well, what's going to have to happen, I think, and Carl, you can judge this better than anyone, at some point, it's just going to create further fissures within the party. At some point, whoever the Republican leaders are, they're going to have to do things like the debt ceiling with Democrats.
Yeah, well, and that's how you get the motion to vacate, right?
Exactly, and that's why it's, you know, I'm sorry, Ken Buck, I know your intentions are well, but I think you're deluding yourself. Carl, you also had a terrific piece this week on Nancy Pelosi and for all of her achievements. I know you know her well. You've covered her for a long time. Just put the context of the Pelosi brand of leadership versus what we're seeing the last day or so.
I was thinking about Nancy Pelosi yesterday. She was kind of in the back rows back there, trying to disappear a little bit. But I'm sure that in Nancy Pelosi's mind, she was going, this is what happens when I'm not in charge, right?
Yes.
Nancy Pelosi would not allow this. Now, like Nancy Pelosi had trouble in 2018. She had to make some deals, but she certainly didn't walk out on that floor not knowing that whether she had the votes or not. I mean, it's just a whole different kind of leadership. I mean, McCarthy sort of rolled the dice. Nancy Pelosi's dice were always loaded in her favor when she wanted to make something happen. I mean, I think the Democrats, as I said in my story, the Democrats were getting a kick out of it, but they're also scared of it. It's like, we have to do certain things. And, you know, if they're not willing, how are we going to get things done? But Pelosi, I mean, I said in that story, Al, the most powerful political woman in America to date, and I haven't found anybody who's come up with another person. She, you know, she really was a very effective person. And, you know, as you can see right now, the Congress is suffering without her leadership, honestly.
Yeah, they sure are. And, Carl, she had her, I know what we call them, fringe mavericks, the squad, if you will.
Yeah.
Maybe not as big, certainly not as crazy as some of the, you know, defund, disrupt, dismantle guys. But she handled them pretty well, didn't she?
Yeah. I mean, she could be a little brusque. You know, as I said in that story, the Green New Deal, and she said, oh, the Green Dream. But I said two things I think really empowered Nancy Pelosi. One, she was a very liberal person with a history of liberalism, and her throwaway line, you know, that, well, you know, I had all those protest signs in my basement in San Francisco 30 years ago. I think that that bought her room to push back against the liberals. Two, she was in Trump's face. I mean, literally and figuratively. And I think a lot of her colleagues looked at her and said, you know what? Nancy is the one who is taking on Trump. Two impeachments, you know, the finger wag, the ripping up the speech. I said, yep. People go, well, maybe we're not getting everything we want from Nancy Pelosi, but we're getting enough.
James Carville.
Carl, I can't help but draw a contrast. Nancy, the majority that the Republicans have is exactly the same majority that Nancy Pelosi
yes.
has. They said, well, they only got a 4-seat majority. Well, that's what she had. And it's just right. hard for a human being not to contrast what we had as opposed to what we got. And it's almost a perfect comparison.
Yeah, no, I mean, the numbers are the same. And she, look at what they did. She managed to make it work. And she knew how to get to everybody. And she knew what people needed and how to win them over. And she did it herself. You know, McCarthy and actually Hakeem Jeffries, who, you know, is the new leader. And he's, I think, you know, he's got obviously everybody on both sides think he has potential. But both of these guys are so untested. And we have had, you know, basically 20 years of Nancy Pelosi, even when she was in the minority, would help get things done. So, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty stark contrast. And it shows you real leadership experience versus no experience whatsoever.
So you're up there, but notice better than anybody. But usually when you have something like this, there would be people in the background, Republicans would be plotting and scheming. All right. Yeah. They think of this. I'm going to put myself in. I don't think anybody wants this freaking job. I mean, I get to see that Scalise. Don't know. I don't want to. Are you crazy? I mean,
Scalise is your guy, right?
Yeah.
Scalise is your home state person.
Yes.
Right. So to me, he is the logical next choice because he's respected in the conference, what have you. But I was actually talking about this with people yesterday, and I said, Kevin McCarthy wants this job so bad that he is willing to put up with everything because he didn't get it in 2015. This is what he worked for. Republicans up there said, this is all he's wanted for 10 years. So he's willing to do anything. I said, are other guys willing to do anything? Because Kevin McCarthy wants to say he was speaker. Some of these other guys don't want to say they were failed speakers. And I mean, I think they probably, if McCarthy, you know, Scalise is a logical alternative. But I also think, you know, it's the classic, the person who's going to take the job can't be the person angling for it, right? You have to kind of sit back and let it come to you a little bit. And maybe that's Scalise's thinking, but it's a fair question. Who wants to be the Speaker of the House? I don't know.
I know him. And I've been talking to this one. I know a lot of these people in a place like this, everybody gets along and we go to St. Paul. But I don't have a sense that this is something that what his advantage would be if they come to him and says, okay, I'll do it, but these are,
right,
I'm not going to have any of this, and it might be so desperate that they give him that. I don't know.
Well, that was the Paul Ryan. That's how Paul Ryan, you know, that they came to him and said, you got to take it. And he goes, well, I'll take it, but not under the conditions that you guys are talking about. But, you know, I mean, to use the technical political term, this is a freaking mess, you know, and it's going to be a mess for a while.
You cleaned it up too, Carl, you talked a minute ago about how John Boehner, you know, hated Mark Meadows. He also hated Jim Jordan. He said he was a legislated terrorist, and now Jordan was supposed to be coming across yesterday as the reasonable terrorist.
I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene calling for unity. You know, it's pretty amazing, but it's just the ideology of these elements of the party is just not kind of what we've gotten used to over the years. People were always willing to make a deal, right? At some point, you're going to make a deal. I just don't know the point that some of these Republicans are willing to make a deal. And for some of them, there is no deal.
Well, in the days and weeks ahead, everybody out there, you want to know how bad this is or what's going to happen, read Carl Hulse. also watch my wife's former colleague, Lisa Desjardins. But Carl, you are the Michelangelo of congressional correspondence. I can't tell you how much we appreciate you. I know what a busy day it is for you. And we're going to keep reading you. I hope we get you back.
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, I like talking to guys of my own generation.
I see that you went to university in Normal, Illinois. Yeah. There's nothing normal about this. It's the last
time. That is for sure.
And I assure you, the two people that are enjoying this the most are Liz Cheney and John Boehner.
I know Boehner is because I haven't been in touch with them, but I've talked to some people who were, and I know there's a certain schadenfreude there, you know.
Yes.
All right. Thanks to me.
Carl's got to get to work.
All right. Thanks, guys. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You. James, for the outrage of the week, my outrage is the new Republican chairman, expected to be chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan, and the Oversight Committee chairman from Kentucky. He's kind of easy to forget. I think it's Jim Comer. Have gotten furious because the White House won't deliver certain documents to them as they begin their never-ending investigations. You know, James, I hate to tell them, they're not even congressmen right now. They sent that letter out. It wasn't only before they were in the majority, but as Carl Hulse pointed out, until they elect a speaker, there's not even an official Congress. So why are they going to be mad about that? You know why? Because they're going to be mad about everything. They're going to be irrational. They'll be screaming and yelling about anything. And Jim Jordan is one of the nastiest human beings on the face of this planet with a very, very unsavory background. So this is just the first shot in what will be a lot of cheap shots this year.
So are they getting paid now?
I guess they can't get paid now if they're not officially members.
And some of these people, can add up if you just keep doing this. And, a lot of them are not that wealthy.
Right.
And they go back and forth home, and they got kids in school and everything else.
Right.
My outrage, I'm kind of sad to have this one, but it's got to be noticed. It is highly likely that New Orleans will end up with the highest murder rate of any city in the United States. In 2019, we had the lowest murder rate we've had since, I think, 1970 or 1971. And, of course, it breaks your heart. And when you look at the map of where people are being killed and who's being killed, you can understand it. And you say, well, New Orleans has a lot of poverty. Yeah, it does. So does Baltimore. So does Newark. So does St. Louis. All right. So does Chicago. And this is not a good statistic, and it needs to be addressed because it's really hurting people.
It sure does. All right, please keep those thoughts coming in. We'll keep our outrages coming in. And thank you. Here are our listener questions. The first week of this year, John in Chicago says, how can Democrats support a candidate for president in the 2024 elections? I guess John's assuming Biden doesn't run, which Biden says he is going to run. But how can they support another candidate if it isn't Vice President Harris? Wouldn't that be an insult to her, John asks.
No. I mean, I understand the question. But we live in an electoral system. I mean, no one gets anointed anything.
Right.
And she would certainly be taken seriously if she was a candidate, but I don't really see her scaring anybody off.
No.
And I don't think very many Democratic voters would be insulted if she drew opposition at all.
Yeah. Agree, totally. Stephen in Scranton, Pennsylvania says, can't they just impeach this Santos character? Stephen, I'll tell you what, they will seat him as Carl Hulse explained. There's no House of Representatives today. They have to have a speaker to have a House. And when they do get a speaker, they will seat Mr. Santos. But then they have the authority to evict him. Now, with the Republicans' narrow margin, I think that's unlikely. But he faces a lot of investigations. So, I don't think Mr. Santos is a long-termer.
You know, let's go to, we've been talking about football. Let's go to a football analogy. If they have their third string safety in the cornerback in the game, and he's got a hurt leg, you know what you do? You pick on him. You throw where he is every time. Well, that's what they got in Santos, and the Democrats need to exploit this again and again and again for everything it's worth. If they want to try to keep in there, fine. Make them pay every day, every day. And he's a big load on their back, and just keep adding anvils to their back.
Michael in Atlanta, remember a couple of weeks ago we raised the possibility of Trump being convicted or about to be convicted and then apologizing, admitting guilt, accepting conditions, and then conceivably being pardoned. And Michael says, do you guys actually believe Trump would apologize or admit guilt?
You know, when people are faced with jail time, there's no telling what they'll do. I think the conversation, it might be more provocative than real, but I don't know that. But he is in unbelievable legal jeopardy. The other thing is, one day Trump became almost irrelevant. No one cares about him anymore. I mean, just occupied so much space in our brains for so long, and then poof, the House crazy caucus doesn't respond to it. The guy's got no power left. He's got no life left. And if he thinks he's going to jail, you do anything you can to stay out of jail.
Yeah.
But you don't know.
Charles in Christchurch, New Zealand. I tell you, high on my bucket list is I want to go to New Zealand. I hear it's such a great place. Charles asked, if Trump is jailed or forced to admit his crimes to get a political plea deal, will politicians like Elise Stefanik pay a price politically? Good question, Charles. I mean, certainly Trump will. Stefanik was the anti-Trumper, the head of the House moderates, who suddenly saw different handwriting on the wall and did a 180. She didn't do a 179 and a half. She did a 180. She became a total Trumper. She went to that awful rally down in Oklahoma in which Herman Cain and other people died. She's been supporting some of the most really vicious right wingers in New York, and she's on board. I don't know. It depends. In the Republican Party, she may not pay a price.
Well, I think the price, you know, first of all, they paid an incredible price. I mean, the congressional elections of 2022, the result, given every kind of historical fact that we knew, every background thing, I mean, it should have been a wipeout. Right. And mm-hmm. The fact that it wasn't was just a stunning result. So, A, they have paid a price, and they paid it because three times more Republicans voted Democratic than Democrats voted Republican. That's why they paid the price, and they paid the price among independents. I mean, they paid a wretched price on Election Day 2022. And as we pointed out, talked about earlier, the contrast between the Democrats with a four-vote majority and this, I don't know if that can be lost on people that easily. You know, because I'm a Democrat, I look at everything like a Democrat. If I were a Republican, I would be so disgusted and demoralized by my party's behavior. I'd be depressed beyond end. And I just got to believe this is going to have some lingering consequence. Will it cause polls to flip overnight and Democrats to be ahead by 10 on the congressional generic ballot? No, I don't think that's going to happen. But this has to have consequences going forward. I just can't imagine it doesn't.
Yeah, you would certainly think so. Jeff in St. Pete, Florida, asked James, what does it say about the Democrats as a political party where Liz Cheney, a Republican, was the most aggressive person on the January 6th committee?
Well, it says that Bennie Thompson and the Democrats were smart. All right. And you know, it wasn't that people like him, and God knows, I hope he gets well soon. Our friend and guest, Jamie Raskin, was not really aggressive or
or any number of, I think Congressman Bennett Thompson did a very good job as a chair. And, I think it was a smart play by the Democrats to have Liz Cheney out front. And the other thing is, however monumentally stupid that you think Kevin McCarthy is, you have no idea. I mean, the reason that Liz Cheney had that kind of prominence, and to some extent Adam Kinzer, is he refused to put people on the committee. But a lot of this was with Kevin McCarthy, you know, who this guy doesn't understand the basic rule of once you pull a pin on a freaking grenade, you're supposed to throw it, not pass it around. So is it just another demonstration of what a horrible leader Kevin McCarthy is?
And also I would say that it was clear that behind the scenes, but almost from the beginning, Nancy Pelosi was very eager for Liz Cheney to take that prominent role. That was another wise Pelosi choice. These are two women who I don't think ever spoke to each other, James, but you know, before this, and I think they came away with real mutual admiration, even with sharp ideological differences.
Yeah, I think to some extent they're similar people. I know both of them fairly well, but you know, I might have ideological differences. But that's two women I don't ever want to cross in my life. I'll tell you that.
That's for sure. Kevin in Vashon Island, Washington, says, I love this question, Kevin. If the pressure gets too great, why wouldn't Donald Trump fly to Saudi Arabia and live out the rest of his years in exile and comfortable misogyny with MBS? I just love that prospect. I really do. I know it's going to happen. I don't know what the Saudis are today. God knows he gave them everything they wanted. They both have the same values, the same integrity, and it would be a great place for Donald to live the rest of his life. But, Kevin, I'm afraid it ain't going to happen.
You know, it probably won't, just like it probably won't happen that he gets pardoned. But I got to tell you, and, you know, you talk to a lot of high-end legal people, and he is in significant legal jeopardy. I mean, yeah. Significant. And, you don't know. In that Olivia Nuzzi, I might be pronouncing the name wrong, but I do, I apologize to her, piece on what his life is like now. It was in New York Magazine. And people should read this. To the extent that anybody detests Donald Trump so much as they like the fact that he's miserable, let me tell you something. He is one miserable dude. Okay, that I can promise you.
Couldn't happen a more deserving dude either, James.
I don't put any of this. I would put it in the unlikely category, but anything is possible given the jeopardy that he's in right now. And the fact that he doesn't have any more power. Yeah. But no one gives a shit about him. And it's hard to transition out of that, but he just doesn't.
James, our final question for the first week of the year comes, appropriately enough, from your home state, Stephen in Morgan City, Louisiana.
Wow, St. Mary Parish.
And Stephen, good question, says small donor donations fuel politics' most divisive figures like Green, Trump, and AOC. Given the anger fundraisers have to whip up to generate these donations, should we be more worried about small donations than the big ones?
So let me tell you a story. I was talking about Morgan City. People used to say, if you ever had a desire to get your ass beat, just show up at a bar in Morgan City and somebody will accommodate you really fast. Right on the Gulf, it's a big kind of oil center. There's a lot of oil-filled roughneck people that live there. So I was talking to a friend of mine who's a big lobbyist in Baton Rouge. And he said, you can't do anything. And he said, and the reason is this, and he put a cell phone up. And all they do is instantly see what's trending out there, how much, you know, how many hits they get and who's following them, how many small donors they get, where they come. And if that's happening in the Louisiana legislature, you can't imagine what it's like in the Congress. So Lauren Boebert or Paul Gosar, you know, they're calling and people say, it's great. You got this much, you raise this much money overnight. And congressional leadership, as Carl pointed out, you know, used to be even conservatives wanted a post office of, you know, clover leaf interchange of money for a stadium or something like that. All these people care about is social media and how many followers they have and how much small donor stuff they make. And it's enormously disruptive to the country and to democracy. It's a very good question coming from my friend in St. Mary Parish. I can tell you that.
Yeah, Stephen, I agree. It is. And it's a worry. I'm even more worried about dark money. You know, my biggest worry, I'm not dismissing what you're saying at all, but the biggest fear I have is dark money, undisclosed secret money, motives of why they're giving it, why we don't know what people have committed to promise to for it. That's my top worry. And then we'll, you know, put yours on the agenda next.
You know, it's like having two kids. You can love them both, but they're both real problems.
Your kids were never any problems, James.
You know, I was kind of blessed. I mean, the truth of the matter is, well, my seventh grade girl was that. There's nothing worse than that. But
when do we get a new Carville?
If I had to guess, today is what? The 24th of January. That was my brother who's deceased. And that's what my daughter says. She really wants to have a baby that day. But I don't think she has any say-so in this process. I think that...
No. I will just tell you one story. For our first child, my wife was NBC White House correspondent. We thought the child was coming 3 or 4 days later. And she did a stand-up in front of the White House at 6:30 at night. And 8 hours later, she gave birth in Georgetown Hospital. So that day wasn't planned.
Right. Like I say, they have their own schedule.
They do. All right. Thanks for all those questions. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor's Real Paper in the show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.